This Focus with Paul W. Smith podcast is sponsored by Victor's Home Solutions. Visit victors.com, experts in home solutions.
And good afternoon, everybody. Thank goodness it's Friday, right? I've heard a lot of people say that today. Alongside for the show today, we have Mike Parsons and Danielle Mason. Mike Parsons, happy it's Friday?
Oof. Yeah, it's Friday. It feels like it should be next Wednesday already.
Yeah. You took the words right out of my mouth. I felt the same way. And I'm telling tales out of school, too. Tom Jordan, when he walked out of here, said, oh, thank goodness it's Friday. So, yeah.
It's that Friday.
Yeah. A lot of us are feeling the pain here. Danielle, happy it's Friday, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Big plans this weekend, girl?
My niece's birthday party is this weekend.
Oh, wow. I love. Is she young or how old is she?
She's turning 6.
Oh, I love those birthday parties. Yeah. They're the best.
So we're going to her favorite place, the Huron Metro Park, to go play it in like the water area or something.
Oh, you'll have a blast.
Oh,
you'll
absolutely
have a blast. Well, lots of stuff still happening today, even though it's Friday. Let's start with the Supreme Court. They upheld a federal law that bars firearm possession by people under domestic violence restraining orders. And this we'll have more on this because there are other important rulings by the Supreme Court, a couple that have already come out, a few that have come out this week, but we are anticipating a couple of more that are really important. We're going to be talking to Jared Halperin, a Fox News correspondent, coming up about that. City of Livonia has removed their boil water alert. Their water sample tests came back. They are good. They're negative for any contamination. So City of Livonia removing their boil water alert. And it took only an instant for the 9-story building, once DTE's Energy's Trenton Channel Power Plant boiler house, to collapse into a giant mound of rubble this morning. Have you seen this video, Mike?
I saw the video, and we live downriver. I did the map quest to see how far away we live. We live 11 to 13 minutes, depending on the route you take. My wife said she felt it.
Really?
Yeah, at our house.
Yeah. All right. So this was, there's a whole renovation going on here at this campus. But again, the energy plant came down today. It was obviously, you know, a big explosion, lots of flames, an enormous black cloud.
It's bittersweet because it's kind of been a downriver landmark. It was a power plant, but it was kind of Dickens-esque because it looked like a big candy cane. And a lot of people who boat around the Gros Eel area, that's how I think they would get their bearings. It was kind of, those smokestacks were kind of like the North Star.
Well, the demolition comes, the smokestacks came down 3 months ago. Today it was just that big power plant boiler house that
came
down. But what's interesting is I don't live downriver, but when you drove through, you always looked for that. So you always knew where you were. And the candy cane smokestacks, they were 102 years old. So they were long time, a landmark really for the metro area. Did you happen to see last night any of the Olympic trials? I know NBC is carrying a lot of these swim trials. Have you seen anything that was going on with that, Mike?
You've been
doing 10 jobs this week, so I don't know.
I did see how they transformed that football arena into a swimming arena, though, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, pretty awesome stuff. So they've got these time trials going on. The 2-time Olympic gold medalist, Lily King, she had already qualified for her third games with a first place finish in the 100-meter breaststroke. But then last night she had another swim. She did well. But what was really memorable was that her boyfriend was behind the area where the swimmers come off their, you know, out of the pool and so on. And her boyfriend proposed to her back there. It was live on national TV.
You know, I saw that. And you know what I thought was lovely? Even though she was still sopping wet from the pool, they still hugged. And he didn't even care, obviously. Happiest moment of his life.
Yeah. And, you know, gave her a big kiss. I'm always nervous about public proposals like that.
You have to be pretty sure. You have to be pretty sure if you know what the answer is going to be.
Yeah, and you know what I mean? It has to be some discussion ahead of time, I'm sure. When you proposed, Mike, did you do it as a surprise, or was it just kind of a known thing that it was going to happen?
Well, kind of a little bit, because my wife, when we'd been together for one or two years, she goes,
TikTok.
Well, she sends me a link to the ring she wants, and she goes, I know we're not there yet, but if we keep going this way, this is the ring I want. So,
aww.
So I got it, and then I had it hidden for like 2 months in a place she never went into. But of course, when I was hiding the ring in there, she was like, she was in there all the time.
And you were sweating bullets,
yeah.
Right?
And then I did it the first Christmas when we lived together after we put the Christmas tree up.
Oh, just the two of you. I like that. Very romantic, I'd say.
And I was down on my knee, and she was looking up at, she was taking pictures of the tree. And I'm like, it was taking forever. And I'm like, if I chicken out now, she probably won't even notice that I've been on my knee back here for like an hour.
Well, you know what? If you changed your mind, you could have said, oh, wait, I dropped an ornament. Wait, I'm looking for an ornament here on one knee, but I'm looking for an ornament.
I don't remember what I said. She turned around. I was like, duh, 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 here. And then we were engaged. Uh-huh. So I think I got the point across.
Yeah, I think that's pretty. I think that's a pretty nice. I kind of like more of a private setting for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know what? I've been married forever, as we always joke about here in the office. I've been married forever, and I don't even remember if there was an actual proposal or if this. Although I will tell you, my husband and I were a blind date. We met on Friday the 13th.
Wow!
And 2 weeks after we met, my husband said, "I'm going to marry you someday."
And you said, yeah, right, dude.
Well, I think I might have been, you know, taken aback and just said, well, I don't know. We'll see about that.
Right.
I was still in college. This was back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and people got married when they were really young.
Yeah.
I got married before I graduated college. So, yeah, but I just don't remember. We didn't have all that. I remember one time driving. Let me say this. The best proposal, the best marriage proposal we ever saw was Christmas Eve several years ago. We were in Venice and we were getting on the boat, one of the little boats to take us back to where
gondolas.
Our car. Yeah, not a gondola, but where we, you know, one of the passenger boats where you get on to go back to the where your car is parked. And we saw a man on the, you know, on the boat dock there on one knee proposing to a beautiful young woman. He was handsome. So we were like, oh, wow, look at that. So that was the coolest one. But I remember one time driving in Birmingham and there was a guy. I mean, I don't know how he did this, but there were flowers all outside of the old Brogan building. I don't know if you know where that is in downtown Birmingham.
I'll Google
the beautiful
it.
Old it's an old Victorian office building. But anyway, he's out there. There were flowers everywhere. There were petals all over the sidewalk. And, you know, there was a videographer. There might have been a couple videographer and all these people standing around. He was all dressed up. He's holding this box. You know, the woman is not there. The woman's not there yet anyway.
Doing some practice rounds.
I don't know. But I'm thinking, dude, I hope she says yes. Because, man, You've really knocked yourself out to do this.
It's a lot of money on flowers.
Yeah, you did it. You did it much better, Mike. Just the Christmas tree, your babe. That's it.
And we didn't have any TikTok to post it on.
Oh, I've got a great TikTok story coming up a little later on in the show.
Wait.
I want to ask you about it. I didn't tell you about it ahead of time.
Okay,
on purpose because it's funny. All right, Jared Halpern coming up next. Lots of serious stuff coming out of the Supreme Court today and this week. We'll talk all about it when we come back here on The Focus Show. Stay with us. And we are back here on The Focus Show with Paul W. Smith. I'm Marie Osborne sitting in today. So as we're approaching here the very end of June, the Supreme Court will issue a flurry of big decisions. We're looking at gun rights, abortion access, social media content, homelessness, federal regulatory authority, the opioid crisis, and perhaps the biggest ruling, whether former President Trump and others can be prosecuted for actions following the 2020 election. Helping us to understand a little more about this very important news that'll be unfolding and has already unfolded already this week. We had a ruling this morning talking about domestic violence and restraining orders. We're joined by Jared Halpern, Fox News correspondent and WJR contributor. Hi, Jared. Glad you could join us.
Good morning. Yeah, that issue this morning with that case is a pretty significant gun case that was decided 8-1. So yeah, a lot of agreement from the federal court. It was a challenge to a fairly old federal law that prohibits gun ownership, possession of a firearm by an individual who has a domestic violence related restraining order. And it was a question as to whether or not that type of regulation, that type of category of individual, can still comport with the Second Amendment. And Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the opinion concluding that our tradition of firearm regulation allows the government to disarm individuals who present a credible threat to the physical safety of others. So they allowed that to stand. Certainly a big win for the Justice Department, for the Biden administration, who had argued to keep this provision in place. And another kind of look at sort of how the court's approaching some of these nettlesome issues. We saw them last week, for instance, in another gun issue, strike down a federal rule on bump stocks, those accessories that you can put onto semi-automatic rifles to make them fire more similarly to say, like a machine gun. But in that case, the justices say that a bump stock accessory is not the same thing as a machine gun, and therefore the federal ban on machine guns would not apply to bump stocks. So, you know, the court kind of taking a nuanced approach here with some of these gun cases that have unfolded over the last couple of months.
Yeah, interestingly enough, again, you talked about the voting being 8-1. Justice Clarence Thomas was the lone dissenter here on this one. And interestingly enough, here in Detroit, today, whether it was this morning or last night, I don't remember, but we have had a case where police were called in on an issue where a woman was being allegedly beaten by a partner, and she had a restraining order. He had a gun. So this is a very timely issue. It's a very important issue, and it's certainly one that offers some clarification for law enforcement.
Well, I think it's an issue that probably the court is not entirely done with. You know, you talk about Michigan, other states have tried to look at these sort of red flag type laws. Right. There's been federal proposals about red flag laws, and at what point can judges kind of step in and order firearms to be removed from an individual? You know, those types of issues also could reach the Supreme Court. And so this is a case that maybe sets some precedent for that. Again, the Chief Justice saying that there is a tradition in this country of banning guns from people who pose a violent risk to others. And so we'll see if that kind of moves some of this legislation along.
All right. The elephant in the room, though, the one everybody's waiting for. We talked about, you know, my producer and I talked about it this morning. I don't know. Do you think it's going to come out of this? The issue with former President Trump and whether or not he can be prosecuted for actions following the 2020 election. What are we looking at there? Any sign that this may come in the next few days?
Well, it's going to have to come next week, presumably. The court's done for this week.
Yeah.
There are opinion release days next week. Next week is traditionally the last week of a court's term. They don't have sort of start and end dates, but the general practice is that they are done the last week of June. That is next week. They've still got more than a dozen opinions kind of hanging out there. So, listen, it's going to have to come next week, you would think. I was skeptical that we were going to get it today, just for a couple of reasons. One, it was the last case that they heard. Oral arguments were in late April for that case. So you're asking them to kind of, you know, write an opinion pretty quickly on a case that they have kind of fast-tracked already. Certainly there are a lot of pressing matters, right? The trial for former President Trump, the one here in D.C. related to the 2020 election and January 6th has been frozen since late last year because of this immunity challenge. So the Supreme Court is certainly aware of the timeline here that they are working with. That being said, you know, I was in arguments that day, and justices are struggling with kind of this idea of immunity. There seemed to be a pretty broad agreement that presidents can't enjoy total immunity. You can't have a president that can just be lawless without any consequence. But there were also questions about how restraining do you want a president to be, especially if they're being asked to make decisions that could have fatal consequences. Mm-hmm. You know, we ask presidents to do things that other people aren't asked to do, call in military operations, even domestically, the use of National Guard troops and things like that, right? And so there is a question kind of about, you know, how you separate out behavior that is maybe key to the office of the presidency and behavior or actions that are not part of the office of the presidency. And so that seemed to be the line that the justices, at least in arguments, were trying to weigh. We'll see how it turns out. But like I said, unless we kind of go into July, which is not expected, justices have summer plans like everybody else. We'll see. But yeah. Certainly you would imagine we get that. But I mentioned the timeline just because, like, listen, the court has kind of had a habit of these major kind of significant opinions coming out in the last day or two of a term.
Yeah, the abortion ruling last year. Yeah.
So I don't know if I would, you know, expect it to be like first on the list of things they're going to release.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you talked about the justices in the case of the immunity for former President Trump, you know, thinking, okay, where is the line? Because we ask presidents to do some things that we don't ask ordinary citizens. So where do we draw this line? And it just, I for a moment there, it made me think, yeah, that's why when we have elections, character matters when we elect a president. So some of this is on the citizenry too. That we aren't faced with these kinds of questions, that we really think about who our choices are for all this. Well, we await these decisions. That this isn't just the immunity one, isn't the only one that still remains out there. So we'll see what happens next week. I'm sure we'll have another conversation. Jared Halpern, Fox News correspondent, WJR contributor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll continue here on WJR, the Focus Show, in a moment. Sorry, big guy. So do you consider yourself middle class? A new extensive study done by the Pew Research Center looked at government data and found that the share of Americans who are in the middle class is smaller than it used to be. In 1971, 61% of Americans lived in middle class households. By 2023, that share had fallen to 51%. And this has created, obviously, a greater financial divide among the U.S. population. And joining us to talk a little bit about that, to understand these numbers, what they may mean to us, Dr. Timothy Nash is the director of the McNair Center for the Advancement of Free Enterprise and Entrepreneurship at Northwood University. Welcome, Dr. Nash. So glad you could join us to talk about this.
Marie, it's my privilege.
Yeah, we love Northwood University, so we can't wait to hear what you have to say about this. When you looked at this, obviously it's not lost on anybody that the ramifications of this are many, and they're profound. We're talking about dividing America politically, socially. This is a very important issue to be looking at.
No, it certainly is, Pew Research does a very credible job in looking at data. As they pointed out, there's a lot of additional breakdown studies of the data that will be coming out in the months ahead. You know, the big helicopter view analysis, Marie, is that the middle class was 61% of the U.S. economy in 1971. It's 51% today. Mm-hmm. However, the upper class has increased dramatically from 11% to 19% today. So if you look at overall middle class and upper class in 1971, it was 72%, with 61% of it being middle class. Today it's 70%, with 51% being middle class and 19% being upper class. So a lot of the news is good news because it's movement from a shrinking middle class to an upper class income group. The negative notes, as you pointed out, is that the unfortunately the lower class has moved from, if there's some data missing if you look through it, but the lower class moved from 28% in 1971 to 30% today. So we never like to see anyone losing ground, but the negative news of the study is that the lower class increased by 2%.
So basically what you're saying, again, based on the data that was the bird's eye view data that's been released, more people moved from the middle to maybe the upper, and but we did see a slight rise in the lower as well. Because one of the things I wanted to say was, aren't we, I mean, when I look around, I see more people who are prosperous, who, I mean, and please, I know you're probably driving and hearing this and going, now, wait a minute, that's not, I agree that poverty is profound in many areas of our society. But when you really look at the number of people driving better cars, newer cars, I mean, go to any boat marina and look at how many boats are docked there. I think in a lot of ways, people are more prosperous than ever before.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. If you look at just data, number of automobiles per household, number of automobiles on the road, homes, apartments that are built without air conditioning today versus the number that existed in 1971. The overall standard of living, the overall standard of life is dramatically higher today than it was over 50 years ago. And again, we need to celebrate that. But also, I think one of the things, if you dig deep in the study, what it points out is that the biggest barrier is not race, it's not gender, it's education. And so if you look at those that are prospering the most, those are individuals that have a bachelor's degree from colleges or universities or higher, and those that are prospering least are those that did not finish high school. The second variable is the children that live in households where there's only one parent. And, you know, it's more difficult to raise children with one parent versus two. It creates more of a gap in maybe either parent getting a degree, et cetera. So those are the two major takeaways as it relates to causal problems.
Yeah, very important to mention that. You of course, mentioned education. And also, you know, yesterday we did an interview on the afternoon show with somebody from the Rocket Mortgage Classic. Their fundraising arm for this big golf tournament is helping to bridge the digital divide in the city of Detroit. And they've established all these technology hubs around the city of Detroit to get people connected, right? Because they know that students, and this is for everyone, but they also know that kids and students who are connected and have access to the internet do better in school. So again, education is so key to the ultimate earning power of any individual. And that's this was a grassroots effort really to feed into that and to make that better. I picked this little paragraph out of what I had been reading about this study. Again, a lot of numbers here, but it is interesting if you can follow along. The median income of middle-class Americans has risen from $66,400 in 1970 to $106,000 in 2022. That's a 60% growth. And this is an incredible improvement. And during the same five decades, the median income of upper-income households rose 78% from $144,000 in 1970. Listen to this, to $256,900 in 2022. That is a huge jump right there.
No, it absolutely is. And those are current dollars. So we're adjusting the income from 71 to current dollars and then showing the increase. And much of that, Maria, is due to technology, as you pointed out. The vast majority of jobs and job growth are in business, are in computers, are in online technology, and all of that fuels the ability to compete, to grow your income, to be knowledgeable enough to buy the right stocks in today's economy. Think about it. If you had $100,000 and you put it in NVIDIA stock in the year 2000 and you left it alone, that would be worth $1.3 billion. Or in other words, if you had $10,000 in NVIDIA stock in 2000 and left it alone and didn't sell it after the many stock splits from then to now, you'd be worth 130 some million dollars. And those are, you know, the key drivers of the future, the key drivers, the internet stock, you know, the Apples, the Microsofts of the late 70s, early 80s, when those companies were coming to fruition. And so the key, as you noted, with the golf tournament and the sponsors, knowledge of technology is key today and moving forward, along with education.
Dr. Timothy Nash, director of the McNair Center for the Advancement of Free Enterprise and Entrepreneurship at Northwood University. Very great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today and really putting this in perspective, these numbers that we're looking at about who is the middle class. Have a great day, Dr. Nash.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Automotive Views is brought to you by Bridgestone. Getting people down the road matters, but getting generations down them, that's what really matters. Bridgestone, visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more. Here's Jamie Butters.
People who are wary of electric vehicles or openly hostile to the technology cheered the news about 4 in 10 U.S. EV owners saying they want their next car to be gasoline powered. But what looks at first like a solid data point of EV rejection is more likely a blip than a pivot in the market. Past studies have found that EV consumers were extremely loyal to the technology. So what's going on? Some of it surely reflects the frustrations of EV ownership, from the inadequate charging network to watching your estimated range drop when you switch on the AC. But a lot of it was an indirect effect of Tesla's price cuts from last year. When Elon Musk slashed prices on the new Model Ys and Model 3s, it sank the trade-in value of every EV on the road or charging in a garage. That unpleasant surprise surely soured EV owners' experience, but it isn't something that's going to happen again. With this week's Automotive View, I'm Jamie Butters, host of the Daily Drive podcast and executive editor of Automotive News.
A headline overnight from the Jerusalem Press: Netanyahu teetering on brink of war with Lebanon and White House. The White House publicly and privately airing its frustrations with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's attacks against the Biden administration, while Israel and Hezbollah threaten each other with war. There is a lot happening in the Middle East, also globally as well. We want to bring in Rocky Richkowski, retired lieutenant colonel from the U.S. Army. Hi, Rocky. Where do we begin? So much happening on the global front, and always in the Middle East, there's something brewing.
Great to be on with you, Maria, as always. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot happening. But again, we come back down to one nexus, and that nexus is Iran. And Iran is controlling, when you talk about Israel, controlling all of those definite satellite forces of Hamas, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, as well as the Houthis in Yemen. So it all comes down to Tehran, the capital of Iran. And where are they getting their funding from? They're getting their funding from Russia and China and North Korea. So we're seeing that what Bush actually back in 2003 mentioned was the axis of evil, with Syria there. But Syria is pretty much decimated and become more dependent on Russia than and Iran ever than before. So we all come back down to the axis of the evil. And what's really interesting is, where is the true money point coming from? Russia with the sale of oil, and China with the sale of products to the United States. So we are, as Gordon Chang on Fox News would say, we are funding our very own demise with supporting those and creating a stronger economy in those nations that would like to do us harm.
Well, just yesterday, I did an interview with a professor out of Wayne State University about this partnership agreement that was signed by Russia and North Korea. We talked a lot about what does it mean. And, you know, one of the questions I asked is, what could possibly Russia be getting from North Korea? Would, you know, there's a hungry nation, a nation with no infrastructure, just so many problems in North Korea. So we talked a little bit about that. Is North Korea as bad? You know, when you talk about Russia, China, and North Korea, what's North Korea's role there exactly? Because I don't know how much they have to offer.
Well, believe it or not, they have quite a bit to offer. And this is something that most people that have not served in the military or don't see the actual actionable intelligence would not know this. But North Korea will export they're individuals, they're soldiers, they're young men to be trained in fighting for Russia. You know, what's interesting is those Russian soldiers, out of the Russian soldiers that are actually fighting in Ukraine right now, a third of them are not even Russian. They're foreign-born or individuals that would come to Russia in hopes of making money or earning some type of benefit of maybe earning Russian citizenship, kind of like the French Foreign Legion, where you serve in the French Foreign Legion. After 2 years, you can become a French citizen. So Russia is dangling that we will pay you to be our mercenaries. Mm. And that's kind of how, if you remember, that's how the Wagner Group stood up, by becoming mercenaries for Russia, because their military is so weak. So North Korea can export those individuals, as well as export food and old munitions that they have. You know, they may not have use for those munitions. That's why they want the nuclear weapon, so that they can play a stronger role at the international table. But they still have a lot of artillery rounds, which are Warsaw Pact. I hate using the term Warsaw Pact because that is just so old.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's the Russian Pact,
right?
The new East,
yeah.
And that East by Russia, they still have a lot of that armament that Russia still needs right now.
All right, I know you saw this story brewing as well, that Israeli military official says that Hamas cannot be destroyed. You know, obviously Netanyahu said, nope, that's got to be happening. And this person says, no, it can't. So what do you make of that? And doesn't that kind of divide their purpose?
Well, it does. It slightly divides when it becomes public. But privately, all militaries look at both sides. How do you win? You have to look at every single angle of a war. And in this respect, the Israeli Defense Forces spokesman, this was a spokesman that actually said, Hamas is an idea. And he's absolutely correct. That can't be eliminated. And saying that would be throwing sand in the eyes of the people of Israel. But I agree with Netanyahu that it can be eliminated. Their control, command and control, can be eliminated. But you will always have a seed of support for Hamas within the people of that Palestinian area. That's what they were referring to.
Yeah. What do you think we're going to be seeing here as we go into the summer months? How much is all this going to be playing due to our political process that's going to be unfolding in this country with a presidential election?
Great question, Marie. From my perspective, I think our political process is broken. The president is trying to figure out who does he get votes from, and he doesn't know who should he angle towards the community that supports Palestinian state, or those that support an Israeli state right now. And that is causing a problem, because as you saw, Netanyahu was thinking that the U.S. is slowing down arms shipments, when in all actuality, we're improving and enlarging arms shipments to Ukraine and slowing them down to Taiwan and Israel. And this is all political. It is political, and sad to say, but that's the state we live in this country.
We always learn something when we talk to Rocky Rutschkowski, retired Lieutenant Colonel for the U.S. Army. Thanks, Rocky. Have a great weekend, okay?
God bless you too, Marie.
Thank you. We'll have more here on The Focus Show when we return in just a few. And we're glad you're with us on a Friday afternoon. Friday, that's for sure. All of us glad that it's the last work day of the week, at least for most of us. Well, we talked earlier about some of the big headlines of the day, the Supreme Court rulings, of course, one that came down today, barring firearm possession by people under domestic violence restraining orders. More U.S. Supreme Court rulings are expected by the end of next week, when the court will be going on summer vacation, because as we heard from Jared Halpern, yes, they have summer plans too. But we want to just give some time to some of the lighter news. It's Friday. Let's head out to some lighter news, take a look at some of the lighter headlines that we've been finding here for you throughout the week. So TikTok has had some unusual fads. Mike Parsons, I know you've been on top of a lot of these.
Oh,
like,
yeah, many a rabbit hole.
Yeah, cooking chicken and NyQuil is one that comes to is mine.
Wow.
What you know the one about the pyramid of milk crates, right? That was just crazy stuff.
No, but the thing about TikTok is the algorithms are so different that there's a bunch of viral things going on at one time, and you might not see any of them.
Yeah, you might not. But, okay, so let's talk about this one, and we'll go back to the viral trend in just a second. But a new trend on TikTok, with young men who want to achieve a chiseled jawline, a handful of companies, including Stronger Gum Jaws and Rock Jaw, have launched chewing gum products called Facial Gum. So they're marketing this heavily on TikTok. Companies selling this gum claim their products will lead to stronger, more defined jaw muscles, improving one's physical appearance.
Why, is it tougher to chew or what?
It is tougher to chew, and it'll get your jawline working, and it'll provide, it says here, correct oral posture. And you'll have other benefits like breathing through your nose and providing 20% more oxygen to your body.
Look.
Yeah, that's what a strong jaw does for you.
The minute that chewing gum makes me sweat is the minute I give up.
Yeah, I mean, we'd go for a run, right? I mean, who'd want to do that, right? Who'd want to do that? Hey, did you see the viral video? And I should have brought this up to you. I know our show was full today because when I saw this, I thought, ooh, that would make a good interview. Do you see the guys who, it was a group of them, they were out, like, I don't know, they were probably having some beers out in the backyard or whatever, and there was a raccoon that got into the car. Oh, you saw this.
Yeah, you know what? It was very hard. It restored my faith in humanity that all these guys would take the time to save a raccoon, which are terrifying to me. And then when he was okay, they all cheered like, you know, they're like the Lions just won the Super Bowl.
Now, as of last night, they had 17 million views, I understand, on this. I saw Mara McDonald do this for WDIV. 17 million views on this particular video. So what happened was they saw the raccoon going in the trash, you know, they're finding stuff to eat, pulled out a piece of cheese, and this poor critter started to choke on it.
Yeah.
And the guy was so hilarious. He said he stood up on his back legs, and it was like he was doing the international sign for choking, you know, the one that everybody says you put your hands up to your neck. So apparently the raccoon was kind of doing something like that. So he started hitting him kind of hard on the back.
Yeah, and I like you hear his buddy say, a little lower, Dale, or whatever the guy's name was. I forgot.
And then I was shocked at the size of that piece of cheese that raccoon that he was eating.
Good for them. You gotta love someone who would take time to, risk their eyeballs and their hands and rabies to save a raccoon from choking.
Yeah, very, very, very cute. If you happen upon that on social media, it's worth a watch. It's so cute. Nothing political, just a raccoon and a man. What can we say? All right, Movie Show Plus is brought to you by Wiggly's Corned Beef. Dine in or carry out the best Wiggly's Corned Beef sandwiches around at Frank's Deli and Grill. 3405 Russell Street in Detroit's Eastern Market. Been there, done that, yummy. Open every day from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. While you're there, be sure to say hi to Victor, the owner. He loves his customers as much as the corned beef. Here's Movie Show Plus.
Hey, folks, Greg Russell here with Movie Show Plus. Sorry I can't be with you today. I'm actually out in Los Angeles getting ready to cover the brand-new Beverly Hills Cop movie. Can't wait to talk to Eddie Murphy about being Detroit police officer Axel Foley. However, we've got two movies that are coming out this weekend for you on the screen and in the stream. On the screen, we've got the new movie Bike Riders. Now, this one stars Austin Butler, also Tom Hardy, and Jodie Comer. And it takes place in the 1960s. It's about this motorcycle group that just kind of starts out as a social club. Next thing you know, Tom Hardy, as the leader, wants to make them a little bit more, I guess you'd say, edgy. So they start doing a lot of things that they probably shouldn't have been doing. However, Jodie Comer's character of Kathy doesn't want her boyfriend, Austin Butler, to get involved. So her main thing is to try and stop him from running with the gang. Right now, let's check out the clip.
It was a golden age for motorcycles.
Somebody told me you're the guy I need to talk to. You're the man in charge.
I built this club out of nothing.
I never felt so out of place in all my life. That's when I saw him for the first time.
I'm Benny.
I have to admit, he took my breath away.
Hey, you can't have those colors on in here.
You'd have to kill me to get this jacket off.
He won't sit down.
You know who did it.
It's another club.
Get the guys together. Burn it down.
Very exciting movie. Like I said, takes place in the 1960s. Very well acted. Again, I mean, this crew is kind of like a dream come true. Austin Butler, Tom Hardy, Jodie Comer, also Michael Shannon, and Norman Reedus. For this one, we give it 4 Wigglies and also an extra pickle. Now let's take you on to the stream. Here's another one that's going to take a lot of you back. It's called Bratz, and it's a documentary on the Brat Pack. Remember that group of young people back in the 1980s who were making all types of cool movies? I mean, like St. Elmo's Fire and, you know, just so many others along that way. Well, Andrew McCarthy, who is a member of the group, has put this documentary together just to talk about all the folks who were in it, what they were doing then, and also what they are doing now, and how a lot of them had to overcome being a member of the Brat Pack to continue in the business. Here's a clip.
If you were coming of age in the 1980s, the Brat Pack was near the center of your cultural awareness. But for those of us experiencing it from the inside, the Brat Pack was something very different. On June 10th, 1985, New York Magazine published Hollywood's Brat Pack. I just remember seeing that cover and thinking, oh. From then on, my career and the career of everyone who was involved was branded to the Brat Pack.
I'm really sorry that article had to come out.
I've never talked to anybody about what that was like. So I thought it might be interesting to try and contact everyone who was in the Brat Pack.
Hey, Emilio Estevez. This is Andrew McCarthy calling you.
Hey, Allie.
Hey, Demi.
Hey, Molly. Let's call Rob.
Hello. Judd?
And there you go. I mean, like I said, it's got everyone in it. Andrew McCarthy, like I said, put this together, also directed it. It also has Emilio Estevez, my favorite. Ally Sheedy is also in this, as well as so many other members of the group, like Leah Thompson as well. This one you can catch on Hulu. And I'll just have to say this much, definitely give it a good 3, 3.5, because especially if you like those movies growing up, you'll find it really interesting, really just to find out how these people are today and what happened with their careers. There we go. This has been Movie Show Plus right here on WJR, brought to you by Wigley's. I'm Greg Russell, back with you next week.
And thank you, Greg Russell, fellow University of Detroit graduate. When we come back, we'll be talking about this major trial, criminal trial that's unfolding in Detroit. We'll have all the details with Todd Flood when we come back. Well, the prosecution in the trial of the man charged with killing Detroit Jewish leader Samantha Wall has now begun presenting its evidence against Michael Jackson Bolanos. A lot going on in this story. And I don't know if we can say this, Todd Flood, attorney, managing partner at Flood Law. So happy you're here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This case doesn't seem to be unfolding perhaps the way the prosecution had planned. Would you agree with that?
It's a tough case. It's a tough case. You have to say, is he a thief or is he a thief and a killer, right? And that's that because they already have him breaking into cars, right? They already have that action. He is at the scene the night of the crime because they have the DNA blood on his jacket and on his backpack. But just because he was there, does that mean he was the killer, right? And that's where the defense is poking the holes into the case. This is a sad, I mean, Ms. Wall, mm-hmm. you can't imagine the tragedy, right? But, you know, there's only two defenses in all of criminal law. Yes, I did it, but I have an excuse. Or you got the wrong guy.
Yeah.
Here, the defense is saying it's the wrong guy. And they're trying to show the incompetency or not necessarily following, crossing all the T's and dotting the I's. If you follow this one rule, as a police officer, you usually can withstand cross-examination. And that rule is, I follow the evidence to a conclusion. I don't take my conclusion and try to fit evidence into it. Yeah. I follow the facts. So, you know, yesterday we were just speaking about this. Yesterday when the MSP trooper failed to examine the fire that the ex-boyfriend did in the backyard, right? Well, why did you fail to do that? I mean, if he was a suspect and you did a search warrant on everything for his house, wouldn't you want to see if he destroyed any evidence? You know, so those types of things. Is there a knife in that fire pit? What, you know, so all those types of things to create that reasonable doubt. But, you know, all cases are tough, and you know, the easy cases usually don't go to trial. It's the tough ones that do.
We Mike Parsons and I were just talking about that particular thing that you just mentioned, where the investigator was on the stand and he was asked about, why didn't you examine what was in that fire pit? And not only right. was the answer, you know, very devastating to the prosecution, the way that answer was delivered, he seemed like a deer in the headlights. I don't know that I'd, I mean, you certainly have all this experience in a courtroom. I don't know that I've ever seen a police detective have that reaction. Like, well, yeah, you know what? Like all of a sudden he went, yeah, wow, I didn't think of that. So it did really looked bad.
That is a gotcha moment. And that is a moment you can see that they didn't complete they put the key in the door, but they didn't necessarily turn the key all the way. They didn't follow all of what normal clues you would follow. That's what you're supposed to do. And regrettably so, is that because they already had their mind made up that this was not the person? The fact that he had a second phone number, a voice Google number, the ex-boyfriend, the fact that he got a passport wanted to get an emergency passport the following mm-hmm. day. All of those things, you know, are signs of guilt, are signs of, and his admission to the police in the very beginning. But there's clearly tracking to show that electronically he was not anywhere around. And now, was it the Sabbath? Was his phone off on the Sabbath? I don't know. In a search warrant that they did in this case on the ex-boyfriend, the police officer says in the search warrant for his home, oftentimes criminals will leave their phone off or at another location while doing a crime. He put that in the warrant request to the cop, to the judge. So, you know, there's so many little moments in this case. But you can't get around this fact. You can't get around that the defendant was there. That's the key. You can't, because he has the DNA all over him. He's mm-hmm. got it on his check some 6 months later. So that's a big issue.
And as we one of the things that I think about too when I've watched this case so far is that the ex-boyfriend also, you know, who the police have said is not a suspect here. I mean, this person's life has been dragged through the gutter because of this. I mean, this is a very, very difficult thing now. I mean, he's got a job, he's got a family, he's got, you know, a life, and it could be badly damaged over something like this as well.
Well, yes, although he put himself in the soup by admitting to police, at least in Grand Rapids, yeah. that he was the one that was responsible for yeah. it. Now, because of his mental capacity or whatever the case may be, he did that. You know, that's, I think the ones around him, the ones, the family, the loved ones will understand that. They're not going to, you know, judge him on that. And now there's witnesses that came up on the stand that said to Samantha, you know, you shouldn't be with this guy for a myriad of reasons. But regardless, there's no easy cases. And the prosecution, is doing a uber great job. So is the defense. This is what it's all about. And I will say this to the police officers and the homicide. You know, we all make mistakes. From what I saw in opening statements and how this piecing together and watching the videos and doing the search warrants and everything, they did an outstanding job mm-hmm. To get it to this place. And this is what due process is all about. There was enough probable cause to bind it over for trial. The prosecution established that. And now here we are in front of a jury. And we'll see what happens.
All right. You know, as you said before, at the bottom line here is that Samantha Wahl, her memory and her family deserve justice here. The right person has to be has to pay for this. There has to be justice for this. What do you think has to happen in the rest of this trial to really come to the conclusion that justice will be served? What do you think really has to happen?
Justice, due process is, you know, you win, fine. You lose, fine. You have due process, and that's the jury. It's the best system in the world. May not be a perfect system, but it's the best in the world. This family, no parent wants to bury their child, and this is horrific. And she was such a loved person. And reading their statements, they seem like an incredible family, but no turning the clock backwards. They're not going to get their child back, right?
Yeah.
It's a monicum of the prosecution believes, and they've done their job, and they're doing it the right way. Let the jury decide.
Todd Flood, attorney, managing partner at Flood Law. As always, many thanks for joining us today. Have a great weekend, Todd.
You guys are great. Thank you to Mike as well.
We'll talk again. Coming up next, we're going to talk with Michael Bouchard, Oakland County Sheriff, more about this issue of mental health treatment in our community, both for citizens and for law enforcement. We'll be right back. The call for more mental health treatment has been a steady drumbeat for several years now. Again, following the shooting at the Rochester Hills splash pad last Saturday, shooting 9 people there, 9 victims, more than a week ago, Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard put out the call for taking this issue seriously for citizens, law enforcement, children, for everyone. It's one of those topics that really needs to be addressed. Michael Bouchard, Oakland County Sheriff, is joining us right now. Good afternoon, Sheriff. We're glad you could join us. Why don't we start by you giving us an update on the victims of the splash pad shooting and where their recoveries stand now?
Yes. Well, thanks for having me on, Marie. Shooting victims, 6 have been released of the 9, and 3 are still in the hospital. Obviously, those were the most grievous wounded, and it's still very much a process to determine the extent of what that will mean in terms of long term. So, you know, we're just doing everything we can to support them and praying for them and staying very much in touch on that front. Meanwhile, you know, we're running simultaneously, working feverishly to try to figure out if we can get any window into motive of this individual, what set him into action on that day. And so far, we don't have anything tangible. You know, they did get into his phone, his device, and there's nothing that has been helpful there. And, you know, they're going to continue to work on the devices and the thumb drives and hard drives that we seized from the home, but nothing to report on that front yet.
We understand from you that he lived with his mother and that she had cooperated with police originally. She does have legal representation now, but that law enforcement was told that the shooter had walked around telling people that the government was watching them and that they needed to turn off their cell phones. It appeared or sounded like maybe he had some kind of break with reality. Was there any information that you were able to glean that they were trying to get help for him?
We have not been made aware of any contact or outreach that was made about him or on his behalf or to authorities or to mental health. Again, you know, nothing has come to our attention yet. And I guess that's one of the poignant things that I've said time and time again, as we look at these tragedies across the globe, not just in our area, is that there's always someone that had the ability to see or hear something and it didn't get shared in a robust fashion. It didn't bring in all of the stakeholders or participants. I mean, whether it's this case or Oxford High School, you know, everybody should have been in that meeting with that young man. You know, I mean, you can go time after time going back to Columbine when numerous people saw those two doing things and acting out in a way that they thought was concerning, but it didn't get shared. And so, it's a common thread. So in addition to the resources, the mental health treatment, the services, we need to have communication. That's the only way we get in front of these things, is if people are in a position to hear, see, or notice something, if they say something, if they loop everybody in. That's not just law enforcement. It's the mental health community. It's how do we interject in those inflection points. And clearly, every one of these incidents, they have an inflection point that was never addressed.
I was shocked to hear when you said that there are an average of 41 calls a day, mental health crisis intervention team sort of calls that are used, 41 calls a day. But in all fairness, Sheriff, and being a little bit of a devil's advocate here, we hear time and time again that in cases where people have reached out for help, they either were ignored, didn't get the help, or couldn't find the help. So that indicates, at least to me, that that part of the system is broken.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's an in-depth, it's a systemic societal process that they have to go through to figure out what steps can and should be taken. Lots of times when we get a call, you know, as you know, in mental health, our only intervention tools are they have to have, be an actionable threat to themselves or others at that moment. You know, but now that doesn't mean that someone can't get other kinds of court order from family members for mental health evaluation or guardianship, or there's different avenues that the legal system has. They're insufficient without question. And that's what, you know, we have to begin to look at. How do we get intervention? Because these tools, the two tools that we have, and now, you know, the red flag law, the third tool, may not address some of these situations where people are acting in a very bizarre and strange manner that they clearly need, you know, some kind of help. How does society deal with that moment? How do they rise to that moment to get that person the help they need in that moment? And that's a systemic question in the mental health code within the state of Michigan, resources to have people that are in a position and knowledgeable that can make a diagnosis of what would be an appropriate next step. But, you know, we need to have mental health professionals embedded with us. You know, we can't be in silos because, you know, that terrible, terrible tragedy we had in Pontiac where the mom was out with her kids and ended up perishing. Numerous people knew she was having a mental health crisis. We actually encountered her and she was very cogent and very forceful saying, I don't need your help. I don't want your help. Had we had knowledge that she was in a mental health crisis, then we could have taken different steps. And that's where the silos, you know, ultimately can be very dangerous to the person that's suffering as well as other people. So that's why, you know, we've been calling for mental health professionals that are embedded with us, co-responders, so that we can get in front of these cases. And then tragically, if we can't prevent them all, and we know we can't, how do we mitigate? How do we respond with the resources to help the community that now has experienced that tragedy and the first responders that have now on a daily basis been seeing these?
We've only got a few minutes left here, but and before I get to asking you about law enforcement and their issues with mental health in terms of getting the help they need as well, because I want to touch on that. If you today in your family were faced with someone that you know was having some kind of break with reality or some kind of mental health crisis, where would you turn? What would be the first call you would make, Sheriff?
You know, I would typically talk to a mental health professional to see if they have any insight into the behavior and the actions. And then the second would be a friend of mine who's in law that understands what tools in terms of, you know, taking it before a judge, I would have to get that person the help and treatment they might need in that crisis moment.
And very quickly, you talked about law enforcement needing mental health as well, mental health training, mental health services. Where are we going to start with that? Is that coming from legislators?
Well, it's not enough. I had to delete a position to be able to fund within my budget, peer-to-peer, to focus on all the crisis. We know that in the last 2 years, we had huge numbers of police killed in the line of duty, but what most people don't know, 4 police officers took their own life and died in the line of duty. So we have a mental health meltdown in public safety, and we have to have peer-to-peer and support for those men and women that are dealing with this every day.
Mike Bouchard, Oakland County Sheriff, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for bringing us the information also on the splash pad tragedy that happened and the people that are struggling to get back on their feet. We really appreciate it. We'll talk again. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the upcoming presidential debate with someone who knows an awful lot about how to debate and debate well. We'll be right back. And we are back. So next week, President Biden and former President Trump meet in the debate stage. They will do so under some pretty strict rules, if you ask me, designed to avoid the chaotic scenes and the interruptions and all the craziness that we saw during the debates in the last election cycle. Joining us to talk a little bit about this is Aaron Call, the University of Michigan's Director of Debate. Aaron, always a pleasure to have you on board to talk about debate and what makes a good debate.
Well, great to be back.
So do you think these rule changes that were presented and proposed and undertaken by both candidates, approved by both candidates, are they going to make for a better, informative, civil, open debate?
That's the goal, and I'm cautiously optimistic. I think a lot of the events are big improvements, and as you mentioned in the preview, the Cleveland debate was considered one of the worst presidential debates of all time because of all the interruptions. So the candidates have the tools in order to focus more and not have an audience distract them and be interrupted when their time to speak. But you could have a game plan going in and you kind of get sidetracked, your opponent gets under your skin, and you revert back to the mean of criticisms, ad hominem attacks, and things like that. So I'm hoping for the best, but sometimes we're throwing a curveball just because of the heat and passion that can interject in these political debates.
Oh, and this one is really, I think it's really going to set the stage for the rest of the campaign. I seem to think it will. So let's talk about what each candidate has to do. What does Biden have to do? What does Trump have to do in order to, quote, air quotes, win this debate?
I mean, expectations kind of go into it. So President Biden benefits generally. I think most people think that Trump's going to win the debate, and you know, he's not the best debater. So, you know, passing a very low bar, exceeding expectations, not making a major disqualifying gaffe, remembering back to Rick Perry during a primary debate, forgetting one of the departments that you want to get rid of, something like that that could go viral, bring up more questions about his age, just doing no harm like that would be really important. And then in addition to that, talking about what he perceives as the successes of his first term, what he wants to do, how to lead the country forward if he had the opportunity for a second one, but emulate what he did in the State of the Union address. There wasn't people thought that he may not be able to get through that, and they didn't think much of that. And he kind of came out with a lot of energy, maybe too much energy, but just proved some of the naysayers wrong and tried to get rid of the caricature that exists of him at his advanced age of 81. And for Trump, I think the same thing, going against the archetype and what the expectations are. People, I think, are expecting a lot of interruptions again, and can maybe being a little bit all over the map and negative. And so if he were to surprise people and be disciplined and presidential, kind of rise above the fray, reminding people what they liked of his first term and in comparison to the current presidency as it relates to things like the economy and immigration, he could draw a sharp contrast, but 90 minutes is a long time. So either of them kind of sticking to the plan and doing that in an ideal fashion will be very difficult and challenging for them.
Yeah, that the bet will be on that. Talking about former President Trump, there will undoubtedly be a question or several questions about January 6th. So how do you think he will answer? And how would you advise him, if you were advising him, to answer those questions?
Yeah, it's tough. As you mentioned, it's definitely going to be asked, and you know, people still have raw feelings from that. The debate's in Atlanta, one's not in D.C., which could even be closer to actually what happened that day. But it's definitely a big vulnerability for him, because it's not just what happened there. Also, you know, whether or not he accepts the results still of the first election. And so my advice, I don't think he'd listen to about really probably trying to deflect, even if you don't want to kind of truthfully answer the question, just try to sidestep it. But if he starts talking about the first election, you know, being rigged and pardoning people who committed violence during that. It may be the base, you know, may like that and his real diehard supporters, but it didn't seem like something that would be very attractive to middle, moderate, independent voters that he really needs to cater to in order to win the election.
And that is, we got to remember, that's who's going to be watching here. This is not his base. This is not a Trump rally. They're going to have a wider audience here. Interestingly, I saw clips of the previous debate, the one that one of the cable TV news analysts famously called an S show. I saw a clip of that, and I saw Biden was real sharp during that debate and very, you know, on point, answering all the very animated. And I don't know that he's going to be able to turn in that kind of performance again.
No, that was almost 4 years ago. And
yeah,
he's, you know, he's 81 now. He was just 77 then. So no, I mean, both debaters have had good performances. Trump did great in the 2015-16 cycle, but they both aged since kind of the highlights on their debate stage. And yeah, replicating that will be really difficult. That was a very unique time. We're right in the heights of COVID, and President Trump may have been positive with COVID during that debate, which you could chalk up to, you know, part of the poor performance to that. But it was, yeah, very unique for one of the worst presidential debates of all time. But yeah, the polling after showed that most people thought that Biden got the better of that debate, and it really helped him in the polling and his campaign. But yeah, replicating that that many years later, even older now, would be difficult. And they had one other debate in 2020 in Nashville in October, and Trump did much better in that. That was, I think, closer to a draw, and so we kind of learned from that. But I think both candidates are going to be rusty. Neither have debated in 4 years. Trump obviously famously skipped the primary debates. That's usually an advantage to the challenger, the proximity of those debates and being more into it than the current president. But we've never had a debate so early in June, and they have an accelerated schedule to practice. They're busy. So it's going to take some time, I think, for them, the learning curve, and to get the rest off of them.
Do you assign this in your classes for students to watch this?
Yeah, so I taught a public speaking and debate class last year, and yes, we studied all the primary debates, State of the Union address. It's a great tool for the students.
Absolutely. Aaron Call, University of Michigan Director of Debate. We'll talk again. Thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward, certainly, to these debates. Thanks again.
Anytime.
And thank you for joining us here today on Focus. Paul W. Smith on vacation. I'm Marie Osborne sitting in. We hope you have a great, great weekend and really get out there and enjoy the warmth. Make it a positive thing. We'll see you again next week.